Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. And for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Well, the Democrats ramp up post-Mueller pressure on the White House. Today, House Democrats initiated their first hearings on special counsel Robert Mueller's report on alleged Russian election interference and its ties to the Trump campaign. In a test of the party's strategy of building public support before possibly launching impeachment proceedings, they are also expected to take the momentous step of authorizing Congress to go to court to enforce subpoenas to President Trump's Attorney General and the former White House counsel, setting up a clash that could also help redefine the relationship between the president and Congress. Today, the House Judiciary Committee is hearing from John Dean, the Nixon White House counsel who pled guilty to obstruction of justice in the Watergate scandal and former U.S. attorneys as part of a hearing on the lessons of the Mueller report. We must ask the question again. Are the Democrats overplaying their hand with these ongoing investigations, or impeachment or no impeachment? And or are they doing the people's work? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my first guests. He's a freelance journalist, written for Counterpunch and other independent media outlets, and former Center for Participant Education, Jack McCarthy. Jack, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Thank you. Great to be here.
We're also joined by journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War, Daniel Lazar. Daniel, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So let's just first get your overall thought, Daniel Lazar. The House Judiciary Committee has begun hearings. Your thoughts?
I am so underwhelmed, I can't tell you. I'm about to fall asleep here. I mean, I think they're greatly overplaying their hands. The idea of winning public support is ludicrous, because I don't think one person in 10,000 even cares what's going on. And by the way, the latest word is the Justice Department's agreed to turn over some of the background material that Nadler was seeking.
Right. We're going to get to that in a second.
But what are they hoping for? What do they want? I mean, are they hoping that Trump at some point, you know, said to one of his underlings, "Bring me the head of Robert Mueller, you know, who will rid me of this meddlesome priest?" I mean, it's just going nowhere. Collusion was disproved; it had no support. The Mueller report just demolished the very idea, and now they're going after the secondary issue of obstruction. But you know, it's very hard to impress the public with the obstruction, because the cry of obstruction, when Trump looks like he really was the victim of a crazy Democratic Party witch hunt. So I just think this whole thing is an exercise in absurdity.
And coming to you, Jack McCarthy, in order to prove obstruction, you have to prove intent. And that is tough to prove. Jack McCarthy.
Yeah, well, I guess that's probably probably true. But I think what Mr. Mueller seemed to be saying is he didn't even want to get into that realm of it, because he believed that the responsibility laid with the Congress to unearth intent to hold impeachment if they wanted to. Apparently, he felt that that was the way he was going to handle it, and we won't really probably ever know for sure whether Mueller believed it was intent unless he comes up and testifies.
Let me stay with you, Jack. I know you taught an extra credit course on Watergate. So bringing in former Nixon White House counsel John Dean to a House Judiciary Committee hearing, I understand the optics, but beyond the optics, what's the point of bringing John Dean forward?
I kind of joke about it, even though I'm kind of agnostic on it. You know, I kind of joke with all these TV reboots. You might call it Watergate reboot. But, I think it's probably useful and educational to hear Dean's point of view on the analogy he sees between Watergate and Russiagate. And I said, you know, I see a lot of analogies and comparisons. It was about a break-in of the Democratic Party headquarters in the context of a presidential election. Now, I'm really kind of taken aback and surprised by the attitude of good folks like Mr. Lazar in the Nation magazine. He often writes, they totally poo-poo the whole so-called scandal. And to me, you know, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of incidentals being thrown around. To me, it comes down to, do we believe in the integrity of the process or not? And I'm really disappointed that folks who write for The Nation and some others on the left don't even really believe Russia had to be innocent. And so I guess I think Mr. Lazar is right in terms of, well, do people care as much right now about Russiagate as they did about Watergate at a similar period? I guess I could agree with him on that level. But I think the seriousness of it should be taken more seriously by intellectuals.
I don't want to get into a rehash of whether or not the Russians hacked into the DNC. I think a number of folks have been very clear on just the sheer physics of that argument and how that just physically could not be done. Daniel, the same question to you. I understand the educational value of John Dean, but that would seem to be better served on a PBS channel, a Gronsky and Company. Now I'm showing my age. What value does John Dean bring to a House Judiciary Committee hearing?
I think very little. I mean, look. The difference between Watergate and Russiagate is that Watergate involved a real break-in. I think five guys were caught red-handed breaking into the DNC offices, okay? There's no doubt that a burglary occurred, okay? And the rest of Watergate was simply an attempt to trace the burglary, the White House plumbers, up to the Oval Office. And that was really a pretty simple affair, which is why Nixon's goose was cooked from the very first day. Now, yes, the Russians may have hacked the DNC computers. A lot of people may have hacked the DNC computers. But the Mueller report is most unconvincing when it argues that the Russian hack was somehow led to the massive email dump that occurred on July 22nd, 2016, that totally upset the presidential election. That is unproven. That is one of the weaker aspects of the Mueller report. So I think comparisons between Russiagate and Watergate are seriously misleading. And I'm not trying to, you know, to make light of election violations, but I'm simply saying that the evidence that some kind of break-in occurred is really underwhelming. The Democrats have been beating this dead horse. They've looked like fools ever since the collusion myth was exposed. And now they're still trying to keep this pseudo-scandal going. But it's just dying out despite their best efforts to revive it.
And let me come back to you, Jack McCarthy, and ask, Democrats have now put on hold any plans to hold Barr in contempt, saying today that the Justice Department has agreed to begin complying with a subpoena by providing key evidence that the special counsel used to assess whether Trump and others obstructed justice or engaged in other misconduct. The chairman of the committee, Nadler, said that he has reached a deal with the Justice Department to obtain key evidence related to special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into whether Trump obstructed justice. If Barr is now agreeing to provide the requested information with Nadler, looking at how Barr has acted up to this point, basically working on behalf of President Trump, I don't see what Nadler is going to get from the information that they now have access to. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm curious about that as well. I guess they believe that there's something there that's, you know, they either suspect there's something there or they want to know if there's not something there that they don't have to pursue. The fact that they, you know, that they agree on it, I think is a positive. And the more we learn about it, the better. You know, whatever which way it goes. So yeah, there may not be anything more to learn about it in these documents, but if they're comfortable doing it, then I pretty much have faith that they're acting in goodwill, and we'll see what happens.
Daniel, same question to you. Looking at how Barr has operated up to this point, basically operating as the White House counsel, in my opinion, if he's now agreeing to turn over documents to Nadler, I don't know that there's going to be a whole lot of there.
Yeah, I assume you're right. I assume you're probably correct. It's a good guess. That if Barr is turning them over, there probably ain't much to them. Look, I think that Russiagate at this point is a giant conspiracy to make fools of the Democrats and reelect Donald Trump. And I think that they're making Barr look good. And the real story, by the way, is coming down in a few weeks or maybe a few months, and that is when Barr completes his investigation of how the whole scandal got going, who was responsible for starting it off. And to me, it is quite clear that this was essentially an intelligence agency operation operating out of London and Washington, an attempt to drum up an artificial hysteria over alleged Russian links in order to essentially block Trump's presidency, Trump's election in his presidency. So it really is the opposite of what the Democrats are saying. Rather than an attempt to sabotage Clinton, Russiagate looks like an attempt to sabotage Trump. And it was an attempt to sabotage Trump, not because of all the terrible things Trump says, but because of the one or two halfway sensible things he said on the campaign trail about rapprochement with Russia and a reasonable solution to the Syrian war. And that was what the Democrats, in their amazing insanity, disagreed with.
So, Daniel, does this now turn into be careful what you pray for?
Yes, yes, exactly correct. The whole thing is backfiring monumentally. I think when this whole thing is when Barr completes his examination, I think his investigation, I think what we'll find is there was massive intervention by the intelligence agencies, completely unconstitutional, completely undemocratic, and the Democrats played along and the mass media played along. I think that is the real Russiagate scandal.
Daniel, final point. The Justice Department policy prohibiting the indictment of a sitting president meant that, quote, charging the president with a crime was therefore not an option we could consider, according to Mueller, adding that the Constitution requires a process other than the criminal justice system to address wrongdoing by a president. I think Mueller is missing the point here. And trying to equate or inflate a Justice Department policy with a constitutional requirement, I think he's confusing criminal behavior with violating the public interest, which is what indictment is all about.
I agree. I think I can't see any constitutional reason why Mueller couldn't have said that Trump, laid the facts out. He was guilty of obstruction, or he's there's a reasonable belief that he committed obstruction, and it's really up to Congress to take action on this via impeachment or some other proceeding. And I don't think the Constitution prevented him from doing that. I mean, look, it's quite clear from the way Mueller has bungled the obstruction issue that the guy is not the sharpest tool in the shed. So I think that the report is a highly flawed report. I'd give it a C+ at best. There's a lot of misinformation in it. There's some good stuff. I love the way he neatly dispatched the collusion issue. But the rest of the report is extremely spotty, filled with non-sequiturs and contradictions of the like.
Daniel Lazar, Jack McCarthy, gentlemen both, thank you both so much for your time today on The Critical Hour. Look forward to having the both of you back.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right, folks, you are tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, President Trump says that tariffs on Mexico have been suspended indefinitely, but according to Senator Roy Blunt, Trump's use of tariffs as a driving force in his negotiation with Mexico is also meant to be a message for China. But does Roy Blunt even understand what actually transpired between the U.S. and Mexico? Well, let's get some insight into what's been and being accomplished here. For insight, we turn to my next guest. First, he's Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, Dr. Linwood Tawheed. Linwood, welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Thank you, Wilmer. Good to be here.
Thank you. We're also joined by a gentleman with a PhD in political economy. He teaches economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California. His latest op-ed is entitled Mueller Talks and the Tyrant Walks, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Jack, welcome back.
Glad to be here as always.
So President Donald Trump announced late Friday that he had suspended plans to impose tariffs on Mexico, tweeting that the country, quote, has agreed to take strong measures, end quote, to stem the flow of Central American migrants into the United States. But it is reported that the deal consists largely of actions that Mexico had already promised to take in prior discussions with the United States over the past several months. Dr. Linwood Tawheed, your thoughts?
Yes, that is the reporting, I believe, from the New York Times. And the last time we spoke, the question was whether his threat of a tariff on Mexico was a political maneuver or, quote, an economic maneuver. And I think we concluded that it was probably a political maneuver. And then it was exposed as exactly that. So, I think that I thought that all the time, that it was a political maneuver. What that article, Senator Blunt, who is a senator in Missouri here, is saying is that this is a warning to China, except that the Chinese also read the New York Times. So I don't know why they would be bluffed by this, you know.
Well, also to Roy Blunt's part, which we were going to get to in a minute, but we'll jump to that right now. Blunt said this yesterday on Face the Nation that, you know, this was also meant to be a message to China. He said, I think the biggest message here is not to Mexico, but to China, that the president is clearly willing to use tariffs. But then when asked later about the fact that what was so-called agreed to on Friday was already agreed to, Blunt said he didn't even realize that. So to me, Blunt's ignorance on the realities and details of this is incredibly concerning. Linwood, your final thought, and then we'll go to Jack.
Yes, yes, I agree. But, you know, the Republicans are falling in line, and whatever Trump says or does, they're going to fall in line. So they're not going to do any research behind it. That would be too much effort. They're just going to go with what he says. And so they're surprised, as perhaps more surprised than the general public.
Jack, same question to you. The president tells us that Mexico has agreed to take strong measures. They've agreed to something that they've already agreed to. So to me, this is analogous to my going to a car dealership, going to a Jag dealership, and the Jag dealer tells me the Jaguar is $100,000. And I say, well, we're going to negotiate this. And I walk out paying $100,000 for my car.
Well, I think this is really about Trump attempting to make a big issue out of immigration for his political base. You can see him doing a lot more of this. I think he actually probably wanted to impose some tariffs, but he got such a major pushback from U.S. business over the weekend and friends in Congress, in other words, that I think he backed off. And now he's just given it a spin, and that makes it look like it was a fake deal. I think he actually tried to go further, but he was pulled back. If you remember, Pence on Friday night said they're going ahead with it. And then, of course, they had to change their position and back off of it and then make the best he could of the situation, claiming, as he often does, that something significant was achieved and it really wasn't. It was pretty much what they already had. I think we're going to see this card played again by Trump, probably closer to the election. Trump likes the idea of tariffs producing revenue, and his right-wing advisors like the idea of keeping some tariffs on all these deals in their pocket to use them again, pull them out again, and use it as a club. We've got the breakdown that occurred a couple of weeks ago with the Chinese negotiations. One of the reasons was that Trump and the right-wingers, anti-China neocons, signaled before the Chinese came over that they were going to keep some tariffs, even if they had a deal. We've talked about that before on this show, what were the reasons for that breakdown. But I think, you know, the right-wingers and Trump want to keep some tariffs in their pocket. And I think in this case, we're going to see it again, because imposing tariffs on Mexico will allow Trump to fund his wall. I think that's still in the play. He probably was trying to do that here and got pulled back, but I think he'll do it again.
And Linwood, I don't really have to take Econ 101 to understand, to Jack's point, that Trump's tariff on avocados and auto parts from Mexico, which wind up in the government coffers, are actually a tax on those who eat avocados and need car parts from Mexico, because the cost of that tariff winds up increasing the price on avocados and car parts from Mexico, which wind up being paid for by the people who buy the goods.
You're exactly right, but this can be spun to the public as if Mexico and China, and at one time he was threatening the EU, that they're paying the tariff. And therefore, I think Jack has a good point here about monies that's collected by the U.S. government in a tariff goes into the Treasury. That money may be available to the president to spend on projects. It's not appropriated by the Congress. And so that money might be available. At least there may be an attempt to make that money available to pay for a wall. But the point here is that you can spin this as Mexico and China paying for the wall, when in fact that the cost of the increased price caused by the tariff is actually being paid by consumers. And so here's a bait and switch again, that the public is paying while there's going to be an attempt to make it seem as if others are paying. And because the U.S. public doesn't know about how tariffs work and where that money is, comes from and how it's spent, they will at least go for that story.
Let me just quickly explain to the audience. There were three areas of negotiation here up till Friday. One, the declaration that was sent out by both countries. Mexico agreed to the deployment of its National Guard throughout Mexico, giving priority to its southern border. But secret talks in Miami between Kirstjen Nielsen, then Secretary of Homeland Security, and the Mexican Secretary of the Interior, Olga Sanchez, they had already agreed to this in March. Now, I think the original number might have been 5,500 troops, and now the number is 600 troops. But this wasn't really any type of big negotiating win for the Trump administration. Then the centerpiece of the deal is an expansion of a program allowing asylum seekers to remain in Mexico while their legal cases proceed here. But this arrangement was reached in December. Again, between Kirstjen Nielsen announced this, the migrant protection protocols, in a hearing before the House Judiciary Committee 5 days before Christmas. And then finally, negotiators failed to persuade Mexico to accept what's called a safe third country treaty that would have given the United States the legal ability to reject asylum seekers if they had not sought refuge in Mexico first. So I just wanted to go through those three things to give the audience an understanding of what was actually negotiated but wasn't truly negotiated. So after 9 days of uncertainty, and Linwood, I'll throw this out to you. After 9 days of uncertainty, did Trump back down and basically accept Mexico's promises?
Well, I suppose you could say that. I mean, if Mexico had given up more, then he could have announced that. but they didn't, or they weren't willing to, and so you announce what you already had. Now, this, you know, it had already been reported what Nielsen and had negotiated with her Mexican counterpart. That was already reported, but it wasn't a big story,
right?
You know, so it becomes a big story if that's all you can get. And so, you know, again, there is a bait and switch in terms of accomplishments going on, where little things that were negotiated before are now made to seem as if they're part of some deal that was accomplished because of Trump's threats. That is, when he threatens, he can get results. But in fact, those results had already come.
Jack, let me ask you, and then I'll ask Linwood to respond as well. How does this play out in the larger negotiating scheme in terms of the fact that the United States is trying to negotiate deals, but is backing out of deals that it's already negotiated? Basically, from what I'm seeing here, countries can't take the U.S. at their word.
Well, look, you know, I've always said there's a two-track trade war going on here. One's a phony trade war. That's what everybody else except China. And you can see that, you know, in the softball deal that was negotiated last year with South Korea. I won't get into the details, but essentially no tariffs, just some quotas on autos. You can see it in the very minimal changes to NAFTA. You could see it in Trump suspending any threats against the EU and Europe, and not even initiating anything with Japan yet. And you can see it in the steel and aluminum tariffs with 3,000 exemptions for U.S. businesses from the tariffs. And now this as well. You know, this phony trade war is all for consumption by his political base, make it look like he's going after everybody. The real trade war is with China. And that's, as I've said before, over next generation technology. All the other major issues are front issues. You know, China's already agreed to 51% ownership access to U.S. companies there. It's already agreed publicly it will buy $1 trillion more U.S. goods, farm goods, and other goods. Those major issues have already been concluded. That's why Steve Mnuchin last year said, hey, we got a great deal. But the neocons stepped in and they upset the deal. They got to Trump and they upset the deal. And what we see now is the neocons driving hardline anti-China policy, but it's all about technology, not just technology that next, you know, industries of the future, the next decade. You know, I'm talking about AI, cybersecurity, 5G wireless, but these are military technologies, and that if China is allowed to go forward, according to the neocons, they may really reach a military parity by the end of the next decade. And that's what they're really trying to stop.
And Linwood, before we get to China, and we're moving to China with the next question, but I want to put a pin in this whole conversation back to the issue of how do you trust the United States? NAFTA was supposed to be, and we talked about this last week, NAFTA was supposed to be a no tariff deal. And in terms of one of the big elements of NAFTA was the reduction of tariffs between the United States and Mexico. And NAFTA, as I understand it, is still in effect because the new version has not been ratified by the U.S. Congress, which means the deal has not been signed by the three parties, U.S., Mexico, and Canada. So am I right to say, how do you trust us when we sign deals and we seem to walk away from them?
Well, it seems to be the president's pattern to make deals not only with other countries, but also with members of Congress, and Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, to make deals on things that he either never intended to carry out, or for some reason changes his mind or is influenced by perhaps the right wingers in his administration and pulls out. The last one was the infrastructure deal, or the supposed infrastructure deal that he blew up at the last minute. Prior to that, it was deals on the Dreamers and so forth and so on. So this seems to be his pattern to make a big much ado about reaching a deal and then to back out of the deal. So he's doing this on all fronts, not just with countries. And you're correct. there's no reason for any country or any member of Congress to believe that he'll follow through on any deal. It's his pattern.
Jack, let's move now to China. Trump has addressed the issue of trade, of the trade row with China in an interview earlier today, noting that the Asian superpower has been devaluing its currency and something has to be done about this. How big of an issue is currency devaluation in this whole construct?
Well, you know, it's one of the choices China has to offset the tariffs if they want. They just let the yuan, renminbi, whatever, devalue, and that offsets the impact of the tariffs. The question is, why is the Chinese currency at the lower end of its range, in other words, about to develop, devalue beyond $1 to 7 yuan? Is it simply because the Chinese are doing it, or is it because the value of the U.S. dollar is rising? And so why is the dollar rising, which drives down the value of the yuan? Why is the dollar rising? Because we got a slowing global economy, and investors everywhere around the world, from Europe to Japan to emerging markets, Latin America, are rushing to buy U.S. treasuries. Therefore, they got to buy U.S. dollars. That drives up the value of the dollar, and that drives down the devaluation of the yuan. So who's behind the devaluation of the yuan? If anything, the whole history of China in recent years is to intercede in the market to prevent the currency from devaluing. They don't want it to devalue, but the dollar rising forces it to devalue, as it's forcing the Argentine peso and all these other currencies around the world. But it's all because of the slowing global economy.
And same question to you, Linwood. Following up to Jack's point, Donald Trump is screaming about China devaluating its currency, but it doesn't seem as though he really understands the economics behind the currency fluctuations.
Well, I agree with Jack that you have the demand for dollars that's raising the value of dollars, and therefore all other currencies relative to the dollar are going to be devalued. But I mean, if we're looking at the Chinese currency in particular being devalued, that means that things being produced in China becomes cheaper for U.S. consumers. And so it is a way to offset the impact of tariffs. But in a general way, it's generally thought to be of value to U.S. consumers if other currencies become weaker relative to the U.S. currency. We can buy more stuff in China. So it's not a detriment, at least not to consumers, for the Chinese currency to be weaker, or for the U.S. currency to be stronger, which is the mirror image of that.
Commenting on the potential deal with Beijing, the president expressed his belief that China will make a trade deal with the U.S. because Chinese authorities need to do so. Jack, does the U.S. really have China over a barrel here, as the president seems to be projecting?
No, I don't think so. I think both sides are kind of equal in terms of their ability to influence the situation. I don't see a deal coming with the G20 coming up in Japan at the end of the month. I think they're going to both wait until it's closer to the U.S. Election to try to get a deal. Of course, it could spin out of control. You've got a situation in China where they have a number of cards to play. It looks like they're preparing to play them, buy China, don't buy America. Goods moves against Starbucks and Apple, tit for tat for Huawei and ZTE on U.S. side. They could not intervene in markets and let it devalue and say, we didn't do it. The markets did it. And they could slow down their purchases of U.S. treasuries, which they have already begun to do. And I think in March was the first month they actually reduced their stock of treasuries. They could make it hard for U.S. businesses to do business. They could, in China, with non-tariff actions, there's lots of things they can do, and there are signs they're preparing to do it. And the U.S., of course, can continue going after China companies and trying to get its allies to also do that, which is having some difficulty doing, Huawei and other companies. So both sides are kind of like, this is the first round, actually maybe the second round of a boxing match, you know, and they're still circling each other, they're throwing jabs to see what the responses are, to use a metaphor. It's not the big fight yet, but it could get out of control, and they could slip into it. There's a long tradition of, feeling that they've been disrespected by the West and the U.S., and you can't discount that factor in China, and you can't discount the fact that you have such a subservient Senate in the U.S. That's terrified at the local level that from Trump supporters here. It's Trump's party now, and, they may not oppose it. So this thing could run out of control.
Dr. Linwood Taheed, Trump also spoke about the forthcoming G20 summit, stressing that if Chinese President Xi Jinping does not meet Trump at the event, tariffs on $300 billion worth of Chinese goods will become effective immediately. Does Trump think that he can pressure President Xi into meeting him at the G20? I mean, first of all, I would think that Xi would do it willingly, but now for Trump to throw this out, is he potentially boxing himself into a corner?
Well, I don't know. Perhaps Trump is trying to use some reverse psychology for Xi not to meet, because there's no indication, certainly, that Xi was not going to attend the
right.
G20.
Right.
And if you attend the G20, then you're going to talk to all the leaders that are important, at least. He's going to talk to the representatives from the EU. He's going to certainly talk to to Putin from China, Russia. And I would think that given the opportunity, he would sit down and talk to President Trump. Now, what they talk about, well, who knows? But there's no indication that Xi wasn't going to attend, and there's no indication that Xi wasn't going to talk to Trump. So I don't know. Perhaps Trump is thinking that if he makes this statement, that Xi will act like Trump and storm out of the room and not talk to him. I don't think that's going to happen. So I think Xi is going to go to the G20. He's going to talk to Trump, and Trump can say that he forced that issue to happen.
Here's the thing to me: if I'm President Xi, first of all, Xi, as far as I know, has never demonstrated any type of behavior in terms of, so trying to use psychology on Xi's a pretty smart guy. So if Trump thinks that he can out psychology Xi, I think he's way off base. And the second thing is, to me, this really seems to set up the opportunity for Xi to meet with Trump, but at his own time and on his own terms. Yeah, I know I'm here at the G20. Tell Donald I might get to him later today. Especially because Trump was the one, many would say, that blew up the Vietnam meeting with Kim and from North Korea. So Xi, to me, really seems to have the leverage here now that Trump has made this statement. Say, tell Donald I might meet with him tomorrow. Tell Donald I'm busy right now. I'm getting my feet washed. I might meet with him in an hour. So Trump winds up running behind Xi as opposed to Xi being forced into a corner. Does my logic make sense?
Your logic does make sense. If this was reverse psychology, I just threw that out there. But
right.
I don't believe that Trump might think he could do that, but there's no reason for Xi to act.
Gotcha. Okay.
In that manner. And so things are going to go as they were going to go anyway. Trump can claim to his base, and I think it's important to think about whatever Trump does as red meat to his base. So he can claim to his base that he forced Xi to meet with him at the summit, and that was going to happen anyway. But he can slap himself on the back and say that he forced this. Now, the issue, of course, is the idea that there will be immediate tariffs on the other $300 billion in products that are not under tariff yet. You know, I can imagine that Republicans would respond to that in the same way that they responded to the threat of the Mexican tariffs. They're not going to be on board for all of that. And in the article that mentions this, Trump is saying that the Chinese will make a trade deal because the Chinese authorities need to do so. I think actually Chinese authorities are less in need of having a trade deal than U.S. authorities, and not necessarily the president, but members of Congress who are seeing their constituents hurt exceptionally by these various trade deals. And I don't think that the Republican constituency is going to be able to wait as long as the Chinese constituency is going to wait to get to some resolution of this.
When you don't sell soybeans, people in Iowa get angry quickly. Dr. Jack Rasmus, final point to you, and we just have about a minute. In terms of Huawei and the president now saying that Huawei could be part of a trade agreement between Washington and Beijing, I thought Huawei was a security threat. So if Huawei is truly a security threat and installing back doors in their equipment and in the systems that they sell, how do you incorporate a security threat into a trade agreement?
Well, that's because Huawei is the largest seller of cell phones in China, and it's 5G. It's the biggest seller of 5G, next generation technology, worldwide. And a lot of countries, including the UK and others in Europe and so forth, have already invested with 4G with Huawei. And to try to break them off and junk your 4G Huawei network and buy your, AT&T 5G is going to be a very expensive thing, which Trump isn't going to want to pay for. That's why he's getting a lot of pushback. But it is a trade-related deal. If technology is at the center of this trade war, which it is, then, Huawei is at the center of it as well, because it's 5G, and 5G, the big pipes give you a more opportunity for cybersecurity. So, it's both military and it's both trade and so forth. So that's why it's in the mix. But, Trump has said this before. He said, we'll cut a deal on Huawei. We'll back off on that. And then he goes and does more aggressive moves against Huawei. You got to distinguish here between what Trump says and Trump's policy, and he's all over the place, and what his advisors, his neocons, and the anti-China crowd here running trade and so much of rest U.S. foreign policy now really says and wants. It's whoever gets to Trump at the latest, he'll flip-flop from what he tweeted the night before. So you can't really trust what Trump is saying.
Got it.
You got to see what the two are going to say.
Got to stop you there. Dr. Jack Rasmus from St. Mary's College in California, Dr. Linwood Tahid, professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Gentlemen, thank you both for your time. We went long. I truly appreciate you giving me more than you had committed to. And as always, I appreciate your contribution to the Critical Hour.
Thank you, Dr. Leon.
All right. Thanks, fellas. All right, folks, you are listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Industrial conglomerate United Technologies and defense company Raytheon are set to merge, but the deal has President Trump a bit concerned. What's behind this merger, and is Trump engaged in doublespeak? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's the host of the Global Research News Hour radio show, Michael Welch. Michael, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you, Wilmer. It's great to be here.
So in an interview today, Trump voiced his concern about the merger that would create an aerospace and defense powerhouse, saying it could kill competition. Quote, "I'm a little concerned about United Technologies and Raytheon," the president said during a phone interview on CNBC Squawk Box. Your thoughts, first of all, on this merger. What does it mean? And what is the president actually saying?
Well, I mean, as far as the second question is concerned, it's really hard to make sense of anything that president says. There seems to be so much that's subterfuge and sleight of hand. But when I look at these sorts of mergers, I just happened to look back a couple of decades when there was that big merger between Lockheed Martin and Martin Marietta. And they were saying kind of the same thing. They're talking about a merger of equals. And I find that these sorts of mergers, what they end up becoming is just a huge occasion for more subsidy from the government. Because the fact is, their bread and butter is these government contracts. And that's what finances their R&D. And what they end up getting with at the ending up with at the end of the day is all of the profits, going to these private corporations. So when I'm looking in the same spirit at this merger, and it's really just more of the same, where we're going to have more government money being funneled into these private corporations. And I mean, the competition that we're talking about internationally, it's with the alternatives, the systems in Russia. I mean, look, what Raytheon in particular seems to be, what their big system is, the Patriot missile system. And we know that they're looking at customers, and of course NATO is the other NATO countries are a significant customer. So I don't really take the competition angle very seriously. I mean, to the average American, I mean, merger equals monopoly. I mean, they're talking about this is going to be the second largest aviation defense company after Boeing, but we're talking about So it's going to be a massive merger. They're talking about big stock swap arrangements, but I don't read much into it other than just kind of like a shuffling of the decks. I mean, there's already a lot that is being directed from the government to these companies for their own private assets. So I don't take that kind of talk very seriously.
The president expressed concern that many defense companies have merged in the past, to your earlier example, adding that it's harder for the United States to negotiate on products like airplanes when there are fewer businesses to choose from. To your point, on the surface, yes, that makes perfect sense. But how many companies are making Patriot missile systems or similar type systems? It's not like you can go to Walmart and let me choose between the General Motors version of the Patriot missile system or do I want to get the Pontiac version? It's not as though you have a lot of companies vying for this business. And actually, in many instances, it's not that the Pentagon is going out soliciting these types of systems. It's the companies are bringing the systems to the Pentagon.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's not your standard kind of
RFP process.
I mean, it's kind of like it's not like you build a better mousetrap and the world will beat a road to your door.
Right.
You're building the roads to everybody's door, and that's how this transfer works. Yeah, like you're absolutely right. I mean, you can't talk seriously about
competition.
In any case, that competitive model. And of course, like there's the whole, there's a lot of geopolitics that comes into play. So for example, you're looking back to March of last year, I think it was, Poland had signed a $4.75 billion deal to buy the Raytheon's Patriot missile system. We're looking at a time when Europe is trying to build an anti-missile, or they're looking at building an anti-missile defense system in Europe, and I'm not it doesn't seem as if there's a lot of appetite for this among the general public. But we're looking at all of these countries that are NATO partners, and they're all tied into this whole global capitalist model, and that it's very difficult for the a lot of these countries. I mean, you're looking into it with any detail because of the amount of pull the United States has with the dollar and so on. There's a lot of pressure there to develop that anti-missile defense system, and so they're looking at purchasing these systems. And yes, it does seem as if, or at least I've heard a lot of commentaries to the fact that the Russian systems are certainly equal, if not superior, but you're not going to get NATO countries purchasing those.
Right.
Well, actually, I should correct myself. I mean, Turkey did make that, and that's sort of a unique case.
Right, but right.
You're creating these customers within NATO. As you recall, Wilmer, there's been a requirement now for NATO to boost their spending. So that plays into this whole, building in the customers for these systems. It's effectively these companies so tied in tightly with the United States.
And here's another flaw to the competition argument, and then I want to quickly get to the military-industrial complex point of this conversation, and the taxpayer is really the ones footing the bill here. When you look at the Tomahawk cruise missile system, when you look at the Black Hawk helicopter, or you look at especially a perfect example is the V-22 Osprey, cost overrun is a huge element in these systems. Competition is not a factor here because I don't know exactly how much overrun there was for the 22 Osprey and how many people died in the testing of the helicopter with the rotating wing, but walking away from a system of this nature and moving to another competitor, the F-16, for example, that doesn't happen. They just pay the overruns.
Yeah. Well, that also partly explains why you have, comparing it with Russia, you're talking to Radio Sputnik, they spend about Russia spends about a tenth of what the U.S. spends on defense for getting about the same level of output. It's the parity is 1 in 10, and it, you're spending on that waste, on that excess, and the CEOs manage to realize the same profits. They managed to, there are no big losses there. So essentially, your Joe taxpayer is footing the bill for these, for that waste, and it's a serious concern, and it's something that should be worked into the rhetoric you hear about big government and the being at the teat of the nanny state and what have you. So yeah, that's it's a complete. It's completely ridiculous to try to invoke any of the usual canards about the efficiency of the marketplace. It doesn't work that way. It's essentially, the taxpayer is financing all of these inferior products and the waste that goes along with it.
And in fact, President Eisenhower, in his farewell address, warned us of the confluence of interests between military manufacturers, legislators, and others. And when you look at this deal here, together the aerospace business of Raytheon and United Technologies produce Pratt & Whitney engines, Tomahawk missiles, the F-35 fighter jet. The combined company, which will be called Raytheon Technologies, would have about $74 billion in expected sales. This is from the New York Times, for 2019. And so that takes us right back to this is the taxpayer funding a merger and those invested in what will become Raytheon Technologies getting wealthy at the public expense. These are neoliberal policies that are gouging the public treasury.
Well, yeah. I mean,
in my humble opinion.
The Pentagon budget has to go up, but I mean it's not for the reasons that the public is being told. The world is not, in point of fact, any more dangerous, at least in terms of threats to the U.S. it's no more dangerous than it was during the Cold War. Well, I mean, there's the dangers associated with potentially triggering a nuclear or some other dreadful conflict like that. But in terms of the idea that we need to defend ourselves from an outside aggressor, that's simply not the case. And there have even been statements from officials not too long ago to that effect. But yeah, you're looking at these sophisticated weaponry, and it really does appear to be driven by that need. You mentioned Eisenhower. I think it was originally referred to as the military-industrial congressional complex.
Correct. You are correct.
Yeah, and so a lot of the proceeds that are going to these corporations, I think I neglected to mention earlier, it goes to lobbying those congresspeople.
Right.
So that whole snake feeding on its own tail, and this is simply... it's not sustainable, and the unfortunate response to this situation is to continue feeding the beast, make sure that we can ramp up the demonization of the official enemy so that we can somehow justify it to the taxpayers and the voters who are going to be fitting the bill. But, we got to keep these corporate executives happy, right?
Well-clothed and well-fed. Let me stop you there. Michael, thank you for joining us. Greatly appreciate your contribution to the Critical Hour and look forward to having you back.
Thank you.
Well, folks, you've been listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you all for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.